This is Paul Semendinger, author of Roy White, From Compton to the Bronx, and The Least Among Them. And you are listening to the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast with Jeff and Leonard. Enjoy, because it's the best.
From the studios of Baseball and BBQ on Long Island, New York, this is episode number 244 of Baseball and BBQ. I'm Jeff the Oku Cohen, along with Leonard Hollywood Aberman, and we're back. Leonard, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, Jeff. You know, Jeff, as you said, this is episode 244. I'm wondering, when do we stop count? We stop counting because, you know, 244, I don't know if I could count much higher than that. That's a high number.
You weren't very good at math, were you?
I'll tell you one thing I am good at. I'm good at recognizing when we have a show that is filled with premium guests. So I'll tell you, this is how we start the show. We start the show by having two incredible pit masters who have been on the show before as guests, as co-hosts, and that is Ray Sheehan, also known as Chef Ray, and Doug Scheiding, also known as He's Gone Rogue, from the Rogue Cookers grilling team. So barbecue team. So we've got Ray and Doug. They're going to talk about their experiences at Memphis in May and Smoke Slam. And then, Jeff, what do we have after them? A little surprise.
We met this woman named Denise at Rib King, and she went to Smoke Slam.
And we were at Rib King, which was an exceptional event. So we'll talk a little bit about that after Ray and Doug. And then, Jeff, then this show is already filled. Last but not least, our final guest of the evening.
That's David Crowell. This is the third time he's been on our show. Another book. This one's called The Fenway Effect, all about baseball in Boston.
He's going for that jacket, Jeff,
and everyone
will understand that if they don't already when they hear the interview. But let me tell everyone that Bet Online is your number one source for all your summer sports this season, including MLB and golf. Every stat, every matchup, and even live odds and spreads while the games are being played. When the game's over, head on over to our online casino and get in on a game of blackjack or poker, or unwind with one of our over 150 slot games. Head to the website today to get in on the action. Use promo code BLEAV, that's BLEAV, for your 50% welcome bonus on your first deposit. Bet Online, the game starts here.
And how are we starting, Len?
Let's get started right away with Chef Ray Sheehan, Doug Scheiding, as they talk all about Memphis in May, Smoke Slam, and everything in between. Baseball and barbecue listeners, I say this all the time. It's a special treat, but this one is really a special treat. Fans of this show are going to recognize these two names immediately. Let me tell you this. They're not here as guest co-hosts. They're here as guests, and they're here together. We've got Doug, He's Gone Rogue, Scheiding, and Ray, Chef Ray Sheehan, both at the same time. One of them cooked at Memphis in May. One of them cooked at Smoke Slam. They've got products we're going to discuss. This is going to be a fun one. So we are thrilled to welcome Doug and Ray to the Baseball and Barbecue Show.
Awesome.
Welcome.
Now we don't know who's who's going to throw the first pitch.
They don't know who's going. Right. Yeah. We got to like
throwing the first pitch. Come on. I want to.
All right. Well, you know what, Doug, you are the longest running guest co-host of the show. And Ray, you are a close second there as far as the time. So, but Doug, so seniority does have its privilege. Why don't you get us started? You cooked at Memphis in May, but you didn't compete, right? You were there representing Traeger and you were working, correct. Right? So tell us about your involvement.
Well, in fact, last year, obviously with Memphis in May being at Tom Lee Park last year, I was there last year at Memphis in May at Tom Lee Park. Home Depot did two demo classes and did the same this year. So last year I did brisket and pork butt, and this year I did brisket and beef ribs. So it was a lot of fun. So I kicked off each day, Friday and Saturday. They had demos on Thursday as well. So Home Depot specifically requested me to come back, and so I was very excited about that and glad to do it.
And hey, Chef Ray, why don't you tell us about your experience at Smoke Slam, right? Is that what it was called, Smoke Slam?
Yeah, the inaugural Smoke Slam. It was the first year.
Smoke Slam was it was an epic 16-hour ride from the Upper East Coast down to Memphis, and actually when we first got into Memphis, the first place we went was to Memphis in May to meet up with a friend of mine who has a team that's been competing there for quite some time, and we actually entered a secret sauce into the World Championship. We collaborated on something. So right after that, it was off to Smoke Slam. And Smoke Slam was, to me, it was epic, but it was epic in a different way than Memphis in May would be. Smoke Slam was more about being like kind of family friendly, feeding people. There was a ton of great food and pitmasters and chefs that were cooking up samples for the crowd to try throughout, and everything from beef ribs and brisket and chimichurri to, you know, whole hog. So it was really cool. It was family friendly event. They had some like kind of like boardwalk games, a Ferris wheel, kind of like bring the kids and have a good day out. And it was a competition with loads of, you know, prizes, monetary prizes for the winners. So, and the World Junior Barbecue League was there. That was really awesome. Melissa Cookston's World Junior Barbecue League. They showed up and showed out. So it was a really great time.
Now, Doug, you've been to Memphis in May. When you were there this year, because Smoke Slam is new, was there any talk while you were there about the event going on 6 miles down the road? Or was it just people, business as usual, Memphis in May goes on? How was it with Smoke Slam at the same time?
Yeah, there was some mention because some of the people that were cooking in the Home Depot, you know, compound or booth, if you will, they probably had like maybe 10 grill manufacturers, and even Gosney was there to the pizza, and, you know, and then they had Fogo and some other, you know, charcoal brands there. So, but and some of those people were doing double duty. Specifically like Mike Starr, I think he was over in your in BBQA area. So yeah, he was actually doing duty on both sides. And I think from the standpoint of the new, I actually liked the new location of the Travis Park Liberty Stadium type. It seemed to be more open and it seemed to be a little more organized. You know, on the river, everything is kind of strewn out and you kind of have to walk a long way to get from one side to the other. But this year at Memphis in May, the stage was set off. It had plenty of area, you know, and there was a lot of parking lot area for people to set up. Not as many of the two-story, you know, like at typical Memphis of May. You've been to Memphis of May before, Chef Ray?
No, so, this was the first time.
Oh, oh, and by the way, I had a 15-hour debacle trying to get to Memphis in May as well, but it was flying. And, you know, yeah, it was weather in Dallas, and I'm flying in, we got diverted to some small town called Longview in a big jet. And, you know, I didn't even know they had a runway anyway. So it took 15 hours and I was just lucky to get there, to tell you the truth. So, but I liked the layout and I liked the location. You know, I had heard it was kind of unsafe there. Or I didn't feel anything like that. I thought that it was a good location for it. And I'm actually kind of looking forward to being back there.
So gentlemen, you know, we know both of you, we met Ray in person when we met him in New Jersey for an event. Doug, we know you virtually, but we feel very close to you. But you guys never met before until Memphis in May and Smokeslam. So why don't you tell us how the big meeting went?
Yeah. So I basically did my demo, and then I had to meet some people, the new CEO of Old World Spice. And then it was like 2 o'clock and I'm like, I'm out of here. I'm definitely going to the Smokeslam. So actually we stayed down by Beale Street. So, you know, real close. So that's actually where I parked. I just parked again at my hotel and then walked over there to Tom Lee Park. So it really wasn't too bad. We can talk. Not a lot of people there during the day, but I think, you know, you could probably talk about it. There were a lot of people at night, I heard over there. So for the music and things like that. So when I went over there, I was probably over there about, I got there like at 2:15. They started charging at 2, of course. And then I was looking around finally saw the MBBQA area. And I, you know, you saw Al Fragoni's area. And then I went back. I found where Chef Ray was cooking, found out it was his demo in like 10 minutes. And I felt badly about that, but he was a very good host for me. So Ray, you can take it from there, please.
Well, I mean, actually it was not great timing because I was going up, but it was great timing for me personally, because when you're far away from home, it's nice to have a familiar face. And when you got there, I felt like I was meeting an old friend, and I was grateful for your support and for your appearance. And yes, I did have to go on and like, right, you know, not long after that, but it was really cool finally meeting and just hanging for a few minutes. And, you know, that's what this whole thing was really great for, like the networking, the community aspect of it. We spent the day, we set up for the bazaar where we were selling, you know, our sauces and seasonings. We were hanging with David Mixon. David was kind enough to bring his pellet smokers on his trailer, and that's what the NBBQA. So I was in, you were invited by, I think it was Traeger, and you were in the Home Depot.
Correct. Right, yeah.
So NBBQA, the National Barbecue and Grilling Association, of which I'm a member, asked, hey, would you come and do a demo? So I'm like, you know, this is great. It's good exposure. I did see a little bit of pushback online from a few people that are hardcore Memphis in May supporters or competitors, but most people were really positive and happy. And the public was really happy to get samples of product and, you know, get to taste the food that we were making. And it was really great to be in the NBBQA, you know, backstage cooking. We did wings a couple different ways. The first day we did wings with this, I call it the OG BBQ rub. It's a low sodium, all purpose seasoning. We smoked the wings and then I used my Memphis mop sauce to top off the wings. And then just a little bit of that OG dust on top to mimic like a Memphis rib, so to speak. So get a little bit of that kind of texture on top, and just to make sure that no flavor was washed out or anything, give it a little pop. And then the next day the day that you were there, we did our Kansas City wings with the Kansas City barbecue sauce. And we mixed in some hot honey to give it like a nice sweet heat taste spice to it. Just give it a little kick. And so that was really cool. But like you said, there wasn't a ton of people there during the day. One demo I did was during the day, and there could have been more of a crowd. As it got later, the crowd definitely built. But, you know, during the week, during the day, with two festivals going on, I think that may have been a challenge. But at night, Memfo Presents, the company that put on Smokeslam, they typically do music festivals. They spent the month in Tom Lee Park. They started with the River Beat Music Festival at the beginning of the month and finished up with Smokeslam. And they had a lot of talent booked at night for those 3 nights. And it was very busy. It was very packed.
That's what I saw the main difference being. So, because in our area, you know, Home Depot had, you know, Thursday they had Tuffy and Chris Lilly and Mo Kayson, who was just on the show, you know, doing demos, and you know, myself and Mike Starr and Robin Lender. So we had demos going every hour. And I mean, like at my demos, I think I had like 100 at my first one and probably 75 to 80 at the second one. So we had a lot more foot traffic during the day, but at night it was actually pretty calm. So it was almost the dichotomy of the two, I thought.
You know, it's funny because Jeff and I, this show, I mean, you don't listen to this show to find out, you know, the team that won this competition or that competition, but we enjoy speaking to people that do compete. It's like the Mets and the Yankees are very rarely playing in New York at the same time, you know, and this, they had both things going on at once. So it had, I wonder if, I guess people planned and they were going to go to one at one time. I'm sure there were tons of people that did both events. Probably, I heard the music was great at Smokeslam. They had some,
yes,
they gave a lot of money to teams that competed. But the two of you now are at the level where you're not even there to compete. Doug, you were asked to represent Traeger at Home Depot. So, and Ray, you're there to do demos. So your levels, you're considered, the two of you have become in the barbecue community, I guess, what Jeff, what am I? They've elevated their status, or they've become, right?
Ambassadors.
Yeah. They're like ambassadors.
Ambassadors, yeah. Someone's a celebrity. I'm like, yeah. I'm not a celebrity.
No. Well, so, yeah. I mean, Ray, it's a work in progress. We're grinding it out, man. You know, we're just, you know, for me, I can't speak for Doug, but for me, I love to be able to teach and to showcase what I do. Like going up there and talking about the wings, I explain the process, how we selected the wings, how we made them. And if that spurs someone else to, like, you know, up their wing game, that's great. You know, it's, I think, like, these two events really were, they're good for barbecue and, you know, having another event. I mean, there was plenty of infrastructure. There was plenty of police presence at both. There was plenty of security. There was plenty of everything, whether it was a bathroom, whether it was, you know, concessions. There was plenty of barbecue to go around. That was the biggest thing. And there was a lot of people at both events teaching what they do and their process, you know, and how they do it. And like I said, I love the teaching aspect of it. I love the fact that Melissa Cookston's World Junior Barbecue League benefited from this. Smokeslam donated money to the World Junior Barbecue League. The winners also received the grand prize, went to Riley Wright, the steak princess. She won $5,000. You know, it's just like the Barbecue News magazine's alter ego magazine to promote youth barbecue, Future of Q. You know, the future of barbecue is the youth. Just kind of like Boy Scouts, you guys were Cub Scout leaders. It's the same with barbecue. It's our legacy to teach the kids, to get them to inspire them and to teach them, to get them to the next level. So, you know, if for nothing else, I think it was a wonderful, Smokeslam was a wonderful event for the Melissa Cookston's World Junior Barbecue League. And for the customers that came that go to a regular barbecue event and don't get the same instruction or be able to sample the food. So for those reasons, I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, I agree with you totally and wholeheartedly. I love to teach. You know, because I teach the Traeger shop classes. And so basically I was just taking a one meat protein and basically doing a 1 hour kind of demo class where I trimmed a brisket. How do you pick a brisket? You know, what looks good? What am I looking for? Trimmed it and rubbed it and went through the whole process. And then, you know, I had another three, and then we served three briskets after that. And of course I use my brisket rub, which because of last year is actually why Home Depot carries my brisket rub in 91 stores. And, you know, I might have gotten a little bit of my Doug's dust on there, you know, my finishing dust. So that might have hit all of my my things as well. So, but yeah, on Saturday, actually, and that's why I wanted to get back to Memphis in May, is because Home Depot was hosting the Boys and Girls Club of Memphis. And so we had, Traeger had six young adults. You know, I say young adults, maybe they were 14, 15, but they were in the culinary classes at their school. And so they got, they teamed up in teams of two. And so then they got to cook some pork tenderloin and then serve it to everybody and to the general public and everything. And it was really good. And they had a fantastic time. They actually stayed longer than they were supposed to. They were supposed to end at 5, and when they wound up, you know, staying and cooking and having a good time till 6 or so. So it was good. Just like, you know, Chef Ray was talking about educating the youth of America. That's how we did it over in Home Depot's area.
Excellent. And I was going to ask you, both of you, because I know you both have product out. I know, Doug, you obviously answered. So Ray, did you use your new product on your demonstrations when you were doing the wings?
Yes, I did. And as I was saying earlier, like, I was lucky to be able to do wings. And it's one of my favorite things. Wings and brisket, for some reason, are always the two. And so I'm really interested in checking out Doug's brisket rub and some of that Doug's dust on my next brisket. But I did use my products on there. And for me, you know, with rebranding my products and getting them back out there, this was a great jumping off spot for me to, you know, for me to serve my award-winning Memphis mop sauce in Memphis with New Jersey on the label. That really took a lot of chutzpah. And I was really like, you know, maybe I was a little nervous because I'm like, hey, you know, it's one thing to serve it to people in New Jersey or in the Northeast, but like, what are these people going to say? You know, like, are they going to like kick me back to the bus terminal or, you know, what's going to happen? And honestly, we got great feedback and people were like, oh man, this is good. Yeah, man, let me get another. So there's a reason why we've won dozens of awards for our Memphis mop sauce and the Kansas City sauce. So, you know, I was happy to be able to showcase the products. They are all natural. That's another thing. Like, I don't have any kind of like, I don't know. There's no MSG, no high fructose corn syrup, you know, da 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 in any of the products. And, you know, when you put up natural ingredients against products that are loaded with it and they do well, that's a testament to the natural ingredients. So I was really happy about the positive feedback. So it was just a blast. It was really great to be able to, it was really super easy cooking on those Bark pellet cookers, but it was just a really great time and getting to cook with people that I don't normally get to cook with. Like, I got to assist John Lindsay, world steak champion. I got to assist Eric Arobi. We got to hang out with Theron Matthews, who makes like this awesome mustard sauce, and his ribs were fantastic. You know, so it was really just a great time. A lot of good food.
Yeah, you were cooking right next to Erica when I came over. So yeah, and I had just seen her at Shields University up in North Dakota about a month earlier. So yeah, so it's good to you just see some of the same people at some of these events. So it's fun.
And she was a guest on the Baseball and Barbecue Podcast.
She was.
There you go. So, and I got to tell everybody, if you wonder, you know, oh, I want to buy products, I just don't know what to buy. There's, you know, so many. These two gentlemen, Doug Scheiding, Ray Sheehan, they stand by what they put out. If it wasn't good, they wouldn't. They're not in it to get rich. They're in it to expand in barbecue and to offer great products. You will, I'm telling you that, and we'll tell you at the end, you know, how you can get their products and everything, but really, you have an endorsement here. They are they're great. They are incredible. You will not be sorry. So we'll let you know how to get them later. Let's just get back now to the Smoke Slam in Memphis in May, because one of the things that I did hear was the money, the prize money at Smoke Slam was outrageous. Now, the winner of Smoke Slam, help me out, guys. Who won?
Smoke. Gosh, what were the?
I forget the name.
Was it Smoke Masters Barbecue?
Yeah, I think it was. So. Yeah. They won $90,000. Yeah. That's unheard of. That's unbelievable. So,
yeah, first place ribs, second place pulled pork.
Yeah, they won 15,000, I think, for the ribs. Yeah, yeah.
Second place. Won. Yeah, I mean it's
the World Food Championship money, you know. So they've got a lot of money back, you know, behind them. So when SmokeSlam teamed up with them, the prize money went up. I think the Memphis in May was what 80,000 or 90,000 or something like that. But which is still pretty good. But the World Food Championship stuff and the getting the golden ticket.
Yeah, but now Memphis in May. You know, Memphis in May is still one of the premier, you know, it's like one of the majors.
Well, it is. And that's why they had more teams, you know.
Exactly. So. Right. So maybe there's not as much money from winning. But I still think that not knowing much about either one, I still think to win Memphis in May, the prestige must be maybe not the money. But the prestige must be incredible to win that competition.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So it's one of the majors. So, you know, in the Shed winning, that's now their fourth major world championship. So they, you know, they fall in line with names like just behind Chris Lilly and Myron Mixon, you know, who are tied at five. And Chris Lilly was actually in the hunt because I think they got first in the Whole Hog. So he was actually in the hunt to win the whole thing and get six and be, you know, nudge a little farther than Myron Mixon. So
I'm going to get a little controversial here. Why not? What? I mean, we had Carrie Bringle on and he was talking about, you know, some going on in Memphis in May and the organizers. I mean, he liked going where it used to be because it was on the river, see the sunset. But I don't know. Is it cannibalizing the area with two major competitions going on miles from each other?
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah, I totally agree. So, you know, with them getting the $1.4 million, you know, repair bill and anyway. So, yeah, I think I'm a conspiracy guy sometimes. And I think it was in the works for a while.
Well, that's interesting. I don't really know the politics of it, but yeah, I could. I don't know. It's very interesting that, you know, to see why it was ended up being the same exact time. The only thing I could think of that is that it's just going to bring more people that are going to come. When it was pitched to me, the way it was pitched was it's good for barbecue. It's good for the visitors to the area, the people that live there, as far as bringing more revenue to the town and being able to enjoy the barbecue as part of your ticket.
I guess in May, Memphis is the place to go. I mean, you know, just the barbecue world is there.
Yeah, it was for that weekend. That certainly was that weekend was the epicenter of barbecue was in Memphis.
Oh, for sure. Because there were, 220, 230 teams with the two. And, you know, that's kind of like, you know, American Royal has, you know, at least 300, 400, 500 teams sometimes. And, you know, the Houston Rodeo has I think it's about like 250 or something like that. So that's, you know, so it gets it up in terms of at least total number of teams in the area as a couple of the other ones.
Now, I have to credit Greg Rempe, Barbecue Central show, because I heard Rashid Phillips on his show and they were talking about SmokeSlam. I guess Rashid was at SmokeSlam. And he had a very good point, Rashid did. He said it's something that could move around, like it could become SmokeSlam Texas, SmokeSlam Vegas, SmokeSlam, because it's not, it could be a moving competition or event, which is great for a couple of things. For anyone that's maybe not able to get to Memphis or, you know, where it would be. Maybe they could get there or it's closer or whatever. And it also, it's moving around. It's promoting barbecue. I thought that was a great idea. Ray, you were there. Would that play in another place?
I think it would. However, from what I'm hearing, they signed a pretty long lease to do it there. So,
okay.
But
10-year lease. Would,
yeah. So, I mean, in theory, that would be great. Kind of like in music, Lollapalooza, you know, was a traveling thing and now it's in one spot. And why couldn't you do, you know, a SmokeSlam in other places? Sure. But
well,
they seem like they're digging in their heels. So,
well, they signed the long lease. And that could be Smokeslam Memphis, but they could still, if it was really, you know, popular, they could actually still do maybe a second one, Smokeslam Texas.
But Memphis in May is always going to be Memphis in May. It's right. Smokeslam, I mean, in my opinion, doesn't replace Memphis in May. It doesn't, it shouldn't take away any of the cachet of Memphis in May. Like, that's the one of the most prestigious competitions in the world of barbecue. So, I mean, it's just a totally different, to me, it's just a different style of event. Yeah, there was teams there. Yeah, there's money there. Yeah, there was music there. And there was, like, you know, boardwalk games for families to play. And there was, like, I mean, it's
and
different.
Pickleball.
It's,
they had pickleball.
Right, there was, like, right, Wickles Pickle sponsored this whole pickleball court. I mean, it's a different, I think it's a different thing. And it's almost, I don't know. It's kind of good that it was, and it's kind of bad that it was, but it's the same exact time. So if you live in town, I go to this one this day, I go to that one the next day. Ultimately, I hope that there is no conspiracy theory and that we're really just trying to spread the love of barbecue. I really hope that's, you know, I wouldn't want to be part of something that was in negative light. So in my mind, you know, like, I was there to promote barbecue. The National Barbecue Association supported both events, as they should. You know, there was a lot of big names attached to Smokeslam. Myron Mixon was there. I mean, he was hanging in the back. He did a meet and greet in the VIP. Would have been nice.
He was
to
there,
have.
But he was cooking Memphis in May. Which
he was cooking, right? Which he was cooking Memphis in May. I mean, you know, but
well, you leave the smoker on, you have your team, and you head over, make your money.
He's got his posse. He's got his posse.
Right. He's got his crew.
Yeah, and you know, I'm looking at the schedule, and I see, Ray, that you had cooking demonstrations all 3 days at Smokeslam. I'm wondering, Doug, did you have a demonstration each day, or were you just confined to one day?
No. I was Friday and Saturday. I couldn't get there on Thursday. Uh-huh. So, so I just did Friday and Saturday. But, you know, Hollywood mentioned Rashid. Rashid was actually and did a demo at Home Depot.
Oh, really? Days,
and he failed to even mention that when he comes on the show.
Oh, well, you're going to have to give, you know, Greg a little, little pushback there.
Yeah. So, but...
They canceled one of my demos, the one for Saturday, because of when it was scheduled during awards. They actually axed it at the last minute. So, which was really interesting to me because I got the schedule a couple different times, and I think it was a little fluid. It was like in motion, trying to get everything situated and first year event. And I think for a first year event, they did a really good job. There, of course, could be some improvements. But I think overall, I mean, they did a great job with everything.
Yeah. I mean, they're experienced running, you know, music festivals. So, and they got some people that used to be with Memphis in May, that lady that was on Greg's show in terms of, you know, organizing it. And so they had some experience with them on their side. So, yeah, I anticipate they're going to go forward and, you know, have both at the same time. So it'll be much like it was this year. And to me, they both can coexist and have their own place.
You know what? It reminded me of a little bit when I first heard about it and how, you know, were people going to jump from the Memphis in May over to Smokeslam? It was kind of like the PGA and LIV golf, you know?
Right. Yeah. That's a good analogy, actually. It's a very good analogy. Just not having the same weekend event for both of them in the same city. But yeah, they were definitely competing for people and time.
What you just said about Myron, that was very interesting, because if you timed it right, that would be pretty funny if somehow somebody did the one event and somehow did this, the other event. I don't know how that would, right?
Yeah, I don't know if you could be entered in both. Yeah, that would be
interesting. I don't know.
You know, I think KCBS, you can't. You can only do one.
Gotcha.
So this was MBN. I'm not exactly sure what the ruling would be on that. But
do you know the scoring? Did they do the, like, first round? Did they, you know, for the barbecue portion, not the World Food Championship portion, you know, did they do the 60% blind and 40% presentation? Did they have presentations?
I thought that they were doing presentations, but I was only over there for a short period of time. So I don't, they weren't doing presentations when I was there, but I thought that's how they were doing it.
Oh, okay. And, but personally, that's what, one of the things that I just prefer the double blind all the way and no presentations and things like that, because it takes the human bias. I mean, we all have biases, and it's just hard to not factor that into when you're judging a team on who it is and if you know them and, or if you didn't know them. Yeah. I just think that's a little bit of a bias.
Now, I just wanted to say too, you guys were talking about when you met each other in person. For people who really know us and understand what goes into this show, it's a labor of love. And we have some great things that have come out of this show. But like our first guest, Bob Kendrick, I've told this story. When we met him for episode 200, I gave him a hug. It was like, Bob, you know, there was something there. It's so nice that you two got to meet. I think that's wonderful. That's how I would probably I'd give you guys a big bear hug. You know what I mean? And so I just think it's wonderful that you two met. You've done so much for our show, for this show, for Baseball and Barbecue. We are so grateful for that. We're not ending, but I just wanted to, you know, we're not ending this interview. But I just wanted you guys to know that this is
eventually how we made it. Len, eventually we will.
Yeah. At some point in time. But yeah. But what did you call it? The meetup? There you go. So there you go. But yeah, you're responsible, you know, because I was like, I've got it. I know he's doing, you know, going to be doing demos or something, but I got to get over there. So I just made it happen. So it was important to me. So, and I wanted to kind of check out Smoke Slam as well.
Yeah. Well, I appreciated it. And it really, like I said, it made my day. So thank you.
That's fantastic. So, yeah.
But Ray, was Kel down there at Smoke Slam?
Hey, man, I got to meet Kel Phelps, the original Kel Phelps. And it was really cool. I mean, like, he is just as nice and sweet of a person in person as he is to deal with the Barbecue News magazine.
He's fantastic. He's fantastic.
He's a genuine person, man. Like, they canceled my demo for Saturday. So I decided I'm going in Saturday morning and I'm loading out some of my stuff. And we're, you know, it's really difficult because it's like Doug said, the way it's laid out, it's all down the river. So it's really long
and entrance.
And we didn't have some kind of clearance pass and security's giving us a hard time. So I get all this stuff on a golf cart and we get out of there and then we go back and we're like loading it into the thing at the hotel. And then I get a message like, hey, did you leave these chairs here? I'm like, oh my God, I brought these folding chairs to be used in the bazaar. And with security and everything, I was just like, you know what? I'm not going back. I can't go back. Like, I'm so done right now. Like, I'm just like, I can't even like the, just like getting anywhere between the shuttle and the event and they ended up. So Kel is such a nice guy. In the middle of the night, he dropped off these chairs at our hotel. And so we come out in the morning, we're going to leave. Cause we left at like, say 3:30 in the morning. These chairs are sitting there and there's no one manning the front desk of this hotel. I'm like, hey, our chairs. And so I'm like grabbing them. This guy comes out. Hey, what are you doing? I'm like, my name's on him. But what a genuine guy. Like, what a nice person he is. He's always making connections in the world of barbecue. There certainly is a reason why the Phelps family was inducted into the Georgia Barbecue Hall of Fame, because they eat, sleep, and breathe barbecue, community, and fellowship. And I can't thank them enough for the opportunities that they've given me and so many others in the world of barbecue. Really a great family. And definitely appreciate all that they do for barbecue.
Yeah, he's just fantastic. I think I had met him before, but I saw him last at the NBBQA conference when it was down here in San Antonio, and I went to that outdoor event because I was out of town for the first couple of days. But yeah, just fantastic. And you know, in my mind, he saved NBBQA because it was a sinking ship. And yeah, he took it for the team of barbecue, for all of us in general, to keep that and kind of redirected it, and it's going off in a different direction and a much more positive one, I'd say.
He'll be in the Barbecue Hall of Fame one day.
Yeah. I hope so.
Perhaps so. Yeah.
I mean, like Doug said, he's really turned around the NBBQA and I feel like more people are getting on board with it. And just now they're going to try to do some more of these live fire events. But like you had mentioned, like maybe doing smoke slam in different areas, but just doing NBBQA events, you know, maybe they're talking about doing some, you know, spread out throughout the country. So that would be really cool and be able to get pitmasters from each zone or each area to come in and shine a light on them and then spread the word of barbecue and the knowledge of how to do it and the fellowship of it. So I think that's going to be great.
More in this area, don't we, Jeff?
Yes. Well, pitmasters, it's come to that time. I know when Greg does his show, it's the time for promos. Both have websites. So Doug, why don't you start us off in telling us how people can get in touch with you and all your social media.
Yeah. So I'm Rogue Cookers everywhere, you know, Instagram, TikTok, which I don't do much of, and Facebook. I actually have two pages on Facebook, and then also roguecookers.com. I've got my three rubs of all purpose, which was actually just featured on a video by Sam, the cooking guy, believe it or not, last week. And awesome. It's actually had an effect. I'm getting a lot of followers on Instagram over the last week or so because of that. So, but on my shop page, I'm on roguecookers.com. There's links there where you can get my rubs. So I've got two different locations where you can get them, the Barbecue Pro Shop and then the Texas Star Grill in Houston, Texas. They ship nationwide. And and I'm on the Barbecue Central show on the fourth Tuesday of the month in the second hours as the embedded correspondent.
And on your Rogue Cookers webpage, I see that you have, I am the Andy Roddick of BBQ. Won a world championship and married to a hot wife. So
hot wife. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. If you're a tennis fan, you know exactly what that means.
And Ray, please, all your social media.
Social media on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. I'm Chef Ray Sheehan. And my website is raysheehan.com. We're just in the process of launching. It is live now. We just haven't put it out there until now. So raysheehan.com. We're in right now. We just relaunched going on about 2 weeks ago, and we're creeping up on about 30 stores. So yeah, go to the website. We'll ship it. All the products are all natural. We've won tons of awards in some of the biggest sauce and seasoning contests in the world. And we're just grinding it out, man. We're just trying to serve good food, good sauce, and good seasonings. So check us out.
Yeah. And you're doing a good job. Both of you. Both of you are just really, I mean, it's terrific. Great products. As I said before, you guys gave how to get them. We know how to contact you. And Doug will never make you decide between shows.
Well, you know, I got two potential future guests coming up, so yeah, you know, no names please, Bill Purvis and Mark Anderson of the grill, you know, the grilling kid. So yeah, but anyway,
well, thank you, gentlemen. Chef Ray Sheehan, Doug from Rogue Cookers, thank you very much. It was an engaging conversation, and we appreciate it very much. Thank you very much.
Thank you, gentlemen, for introducing us. Our hells, this would never have happened. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Gary Mack of the Mets Musings podcast, and if you like barbecue and you like baseball, then you have to listen to Baseball and BBQ with Jeff and Len. They always have the best guests from the world of baseball and the world of barbecue, all in one little package. So check it out. Baseball and BBQ with Len and Jeff. Okay, guys, take it away.
And thank you, Ray. Thank you, Doug. All About Memphis and May that happened last month. And they met each other.
Yes, they absolutely did. You know what, Jeff? We are very lucky because, as they say, we caught both of them, Ray and Doug, on their way up. They are such nice people that they would still grace us with their presence, but we got lucky. We met them as their stars were rising, and it is amazing how they are in such demand right now. So thank you, Ray. Thank you, Doug. And Jeff, I want to thank someone else.
Oh, who's that?
That is Jimmy Carbone.
Ah.
Because he invited us to be his guests at Rib King, which was an event near us, was actually in Brooklyn. And while we were there, we met Denise, who was wearing a SmokeSlam t-shirt. So we knew she must have something to do with the first ever SmokeSlam. And the funny thing is, she recognized us. Mm-hmm. So why don't we listen as we talk with Denise at Rib King? We're here at Rib King 2024. I love how we run into people that we've seen before. So we're here with Denise. She's wearing a SmokeSlam t-shirt. And you know there's only one SmokeSlam. So Denise, you just got back from SmokeSlam last weekend.
Yeah, we just got back. So we drove down. We left from New Jersey. We drove down. We went to the event. It was at Tom Lee Park, right on the water. Beautiful event, nicely done. It was a really good time. So I was on the only all-female team called I Only Smoke When I Drink.
Oh.
And we were able to bring in 3 top 10 dishes in the competition.
Congratulations.
Very nice. Wow. Time. Yeah.
So did you win money?
I think the team won money.
All right. Yeah. Very nice. You know, the winning team won like 90 grand.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a good purse for the event. Yeah. But it was a really lovely time. Weather held out. The event planners were very wonderful. It was a nice time. Are you guys planning on going down next year?
Yeah.
There's a chance of that. Yeah. Yeah.
Wonderful.
We have to, you know, every time we go to an event like that, we are a real barbecue podcast. So now wait a second. So you went to SmokeSlam. Have you been to Memphis in May?
We were at Memphis in May last year. Yeah.
Okay. So, and this year you did SmokeSlam. Did you happen to head over to Memphis in May and see what it was like this year?
I didn't. We didn't have the time to do that, but we did meet up with some of our friends to eat, like, outside of competition hours, because we know, obviously, a number of people who were at Memphis in May, so that was nice.
Yeah.
We met up with a few of the team members from Boar's Night Out.
Oh, okay, Boar's Night Out. We heard of them.
Yeah. So then how was it having the two events going on at the same time?
SmokeSlam was great. It was tough. You want to see everybody else. You want to see all the other teams that you know and you're familiar with,
right.
But you're in two different locations. But it was a wonderful time.
Wow.
So then my final question for you is, you're at SmokeSlam and we heard somebody suggest this actually on another show, Rashid Phillips, and his suggestion was that they have SmokeSlam, but in different places each year. Now, I heard they just signed a 10-year lease, but they could still move it around. They could have it there in Memphis and still do it in other places. How do you think SmokeSlam would translate, like if it was in New York, New Jersey, Vegas?
I think wherever they go, it's going to be wonderful. The event planners did a great job. It was very nicely done. It was a good time, brought people together. It's, you know, when you're talking barbecue, you're talking family. Absolutely. So it's always a good time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, we thank you very much.
Very nice to see you guys again.
Nice seeing you too. Thank you very much, Denise. Jeff, Rib King, you want to just say a couple of quick things about it? Because it really is an event that should get some press, and it does, but it's such a fantastic event put on by Jimmy Carbone.
Oh yeah, it was very fun. A lot of fun, a lot of vendors, a lot of ribs, and it was just a really nice day out in Brooklyn. It was dry, thank goodness, and it was just a lot of fun. Met a lot of people, so it was a good time.
Jeff, did you ever think that ribs could be made in so many different ways?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. And you know what? You never would think that tongs and spatulas and cutting boards could be so different, but they are. And the only way you're going to find that out is if you go to baseballbbq.com and you will see grilling tools with baseball bat handles, cutting boards shaped like jerseys, baseball jerseys, cutting boards shaped like home plate. Head to baseballbbq.com. It is grilling season, so don't wait. Get over there now.
And if you want to reach the show, you can give us a call, 516-855-8214. Email is baseballandbbq@gmail.com. Leave a message on our Facebook page, Baseball and BBQ. Leave a message on our X at Baseball and BBQ. Instagram, Baseball and Barbecue. Barbecue's all spelled out. Our website is www.baseballandbbq.weebly.com. Please rate, review, tell your friends.
Subscribe.
Yep.
Give us 5 stars. Thank you very much. And Jeff, now give us something that we wait all week for.
It's time for the Baseball Quote of the Week.
Baseball, to me, is still a national pastime because it is a summer game. I feel that almost all Americans are summer people, that summer is what they think of when they think about their childhood. I think it stirs up an incredible emotion within people. That was Steve Busby, who pitched for the Kansas City Royals from 1972 to 1980.
Wow. Very nice quote. Very well said. Very nice. You know what else is nice, Jeff?
What?
David Krell. He's nice enough to come on with us for the third time to talk about his third book, which is called The Fenway Effect. So let's get right to it.
Today, our guest becomes the first member of the Baseball and BBQ Three-Timer Club. He has been on episode 129 to talk about his book, 1962, Baseball and America in the Time of JFK, and on episode 182, talking about Do You Believe in Magic? Baseball and America in the Groundbreaking Year of 1966. And today he is with us with his new book, The Fenway Effect, A Cultural History of the Boston Red Sox. Available now wherever books are sold. He's also the chair of the Northern New Jersey chapter of Sabre. We welcome back David Krell. Welcome, David.
Thank you, guys. How are you?
Good, thanks,
David. Good, thank you.
Welcome back. As they say, third time is the charm. Right, David?
Do I get a jacket if I come on 5 times like the SNL hosts?
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, you are prolific with your books. So many things that I wanted to say. One thing, though, I thought as Met fans that we have this connection and this love of our team. But you read this book and you know Boston loves their sports, loves the Red Sox.
There is something palpable about being a Red Sox fan, going to Fenway Park. The last chapter is an oral history chapter, and I put the word out to my Sabre chapter in New Jersey, to the Sabre chapter in Boston, email lists, Facebook, Twitter, and I got back responses from fans who did not send me paragraphs in response to my questions. Pages that went on, 6, 7, 8 pages. And people told me when I write about the Red Sox, when I talk about the Red Sox, I can't stop. And there's something to be said for that. There is such a deep love that goes back generations. And part of it has to do with Fenway Park, because you could be sitting in the seat that your great-grandfather sat in. And there's something very transitional through the generations. I can't put my finger on it, but the energy is definitely there.
Yeah. So let's just, for anyone that isn't familiar with David's books, he's written books that focus on years in baseball. They talk about other things going on at the time. And this book has some of that as well. I mean, you talk about the TV shows that are going on, but a lot of them are Boston associated. Like,
right.
I love reading about Cheers, one of the best sitcoms, and the way Boston, those fans in that bar,
yeah,
could be fans in Boston. I mean, it that they're portraying on that show is really how you get the feeling it is in Boston.
Especially in the first 2 seasons, where the Red Sox mentions in dialogue are so prominent. And in at least one episode that I can remember, it's a focal point. Sam's former catcher has a new book and he comes out as gay. And that was mm-hmm. a revolutionary episode for the early 80s. And throughout the 11 years, they had mentions, but especially in the first 2 years where they really cemented the relationship between the city and the characters. And that's not unusual in a show, but I had forgotten that because I hadn't seen the show in, you know, 30, 40 years. Going back and seeing how genius it was to do that subtly, you know, going to Fenway Park, going to the Celtics game, mentioning the Patriots. Carla's husband was a hockey goalie for the Bruins, and he had a recurring role. So I think you're quite right. And Cheers is one of the greatest sitcoms, and I think a lot of it is because of that verisimilitude. It feels real. It feels like these guys could be in a Boston bar talking about sports, talking about popular culture.
And Pantsing Wade Boggs.
Pantsing Wade Boggs.
Yeah, I want to reiterate what Len said. Great book. A lot of things that, you know, obviously we learn as we're reading the book, we learn about, you know, I learned a lot about the Jimmy Fund in this book. I mean, I knew the Red Sox was associated with the Jimmy Fund. I knew Ted Williams. I didn't know how deeply he was involved with the Jimmy Fund. I didn't know that it actually started gaining popularity, I guess, with a radio show, Truth of Consequences. Yeah. That was amazing. And the person who that the Jimmy, in quotes, was still alive years later.
Right. It originated on an episode of Truth or Consequences where a sick kid nicknamed Jimmy for purposes of the show to protect his identity was given gifts relating to the Boston Braves. That was his team. And players came in, the manager came in. But when the Braves left for Milwaukee, the Red Sox inherited that obligation and became synonymous with the Jimmy Fund. One of my favorite moments from Fever Pitch with Jimmy Fallon is seeing the apartment with all the memorabilia and a vintage ad or a replica of an ad for the Jimmy Fund. Mm-hmm. And that tied the character to Red Sox history and lore.
Sure.
That movie does not work if it's, I think it works if it's the Cubs, they have mm-hmm. a dedication, but there's very few, you feel that knowing the love, you definitely understand that movie. Now, Jeff mentioned Ted Williams, and he's mentioned, I mean, Ted Williams is part of, it's incredible, you know, what he meant to that team. And then, of course, Yastrzemski following up. But I want to just focus on Ted Williams. And what I want to go to is his Hall of Fame speech. Mm-hmm. And in his speech, he did something that, maybe it wasn't, you know, it was a few sentences or whatever, but he brought attention to Negro League players who were not in the Hall of Fame, and he mentioned them. And that was a, maybe even brave at the time to do that. And then it made me, of course, then we're reading about Tom Yawkey, who was the owner. And I had heard, you know, various, you know, things I've read and everything. He was definitely... he was racist. Are we agreed on that? That Tom Yawkey was, or I want to ask you, David, because I know they've changed things. Like there was Yawkey Way, and now
right. They
took that away. Was Tom Yawkey racist? Is that how he should be remembered? Or
there are people who have done much more research on this than I have, so I would defer to them on any labels. But I will say it's unfair to say that he was alone. Because the trivia question is, who was the last team to integrate, followed by what was the name of the player,
right?
Followed by what was the year. Boston Red Sox, Pumpsy Green, 1959. Jackie Robinson breaks the color line in 47. There's a lot of real estate in time between 47 and 59. Now, I might have my years wrong, but I believe the Tigers did not integrate until 1958, the Phillies until 1957, the Yankees until 1955. So to say that Robinson broke the color line and then everyone opened the gates is just incorrect.
Right.
It was only a year before Pumpsy Green that Detroit integrated. So to look at it through that paradigm, I think offers some context. He wasn't alone. And the Red Sox paid for that. They paid for it on the field by not having black players, by not having Hispanic players until much later. And then, of course, they got George Scott and Jim Rice and other players who became icons.
But you mentioned in the book that wasn't there a tryout of Jackie Robinson that was trying? right?
There was a tryout, but I think that was to pay lip service to a Boston City councilman. There was a lot of, you know, it was just a show. There was no, mm-hmm. there was no way they were going to sign him. There's no documentation that they were really, really looking at him. But the Dodgers did look at him.
Let's move on to some happier subjects. In one of the chapters, it's called Songs of the Sox. Songs of the Sox. And you talk about the group Dropkick Murphys. And they have the song Dirty Water, which is associated with Red Sox. But obviously, everybody thinks Sweet Caroline is associated with the Red Sox, which they play, I believe, in the eighth inning. The time that I've been to Fenway Park was played in the eighth inning, and everybody gets into that song. And actually, when the inning starts, people are still singing the song.
Yeah. Well, music plays such an important part of sports. And I felt that having done the research, it deserved its own chapter, that I couldn't just lump in entertainment into one chapter and one section. Sweet Caroline, Tessie certainly is a big part, Dirty Water. And this goes back 120 years. This has been an integral part of Red Sox culture. It's not something that just happened with Sweet Caroline. And one of the people I write about in the book is Nuff Said McGreevy, mm-hmm. who was baseball's first super fan, or at least Boston's first super fan. If Nuff Said McGreevy could be resurrected and put at a Red Sox home game, I think he'd feel right at home with Sweet Caroline.
Mm-hmm.
The musical legacy continues.
Is Caroline Kennedy?
That's the lore, but mm-hmm. the truth is he just needed a three-syllable word and Neil Diamond, and he had a book about the Kennedys, I believe, and it fit. It fit. It's just as simple as that. Sometimes there's no rhyme or reason to it.
Right. Well, I guess Bostonites would just go with the myth and keep that as their own.
What's that movie? The man who shot Liberty Valance, when legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Right, exactly.
And David, I like I remember that from the movie Ted, for anyone who didn't see it, is when the teddy bear comes to life and when the guy's looking for him and he says, he starts singing Sweet Caroline because he knows that any Red Sox fan will do so good. And he did.
He does ba ba ba. That's ba ba ba.
Okay, which is what I did.
That's the line that no fan can exist. And he knew that Ted would fall victim to it.
So there's so many references in the book to that. And I know Jeff said let's talk about happier things, but there is something that happened in Red Sox history. Well, it was Boston history, and that was the bombing at the end of the marathon. You go into detail in the book, and then now all of a sudden I can't remember who sings Sweet Caroline.
Neil Diamond.
Yeah, thank you, Neil Diamond, how he came to perform it at the Red Sox game, and the city came together, and it was just, you know, it was basically the Red Sox and the city and saying, nothing's going to keep us down. That was a very moving chapter.
Thank you. I put that first for a reason. I thought it was so emphatic, and I know some people in Boston, and they're still very emotional about that week and about that game, which proves that baseball can tie people together. You saw what happened in 2001 mm-hmm. when George W. Bush took the mound at Yankee Stadium and threw out the first pitch. There was something resonant about that. David Ortiz giving his rather florid but succinct speech was unifying for New Englanders.
Yes, absolutely. And also, we can't forget the Piazza home run, the first game back after 9/11. That was just brought people together, absolutely. Chapter 5, High Neighbor, Kirk Gowdy, Narragansett Beer, and the Red Sox.
Right.
I thought that was, I mean, I'm not a big beer drinker, but the beer, I'm probably mispronouncing it, Narragansett Beer, played that such a big role in New England. I had no idea. And even Kirk Gowdy, announcing and everything.
I didn't either. Kurt Gowdy was a little before my time, and I never heard of Narragansett until I did the research. And the more I got into it, the more I realized it deserves its own chapter. There was such a rich history about the beer company. And then Kurt Gowdy's history, his biography, going through his biography, his autobiography, and seeing how he changed jobs and became a national broadcaster to spend time with his family. Narragansett going down the wayside, it got resurrected as a brand by some entrepreneurs, which I was very happy to chronicle. And I think that beer and baseball go together, but again, there was something terribly emotional about the brand Narragansett, because for so many decades, it was part of the soundtrack of people's lives.
Yeah. And David, so many talk about Ted Williams, and then he retires, and then Carl Yastrzemski. I mean, he's not Ted Williams, but he's damn close. They don't miss a beat.
Well, Carl Yastrzemski had really big shoes to fill. You're replacing a legend, and he became a legend in his own right. And again, they're beloved figures in New England. They look at their players differently than Mets fans look at their players or Yankees fans look at their players. There's such an emotional bond that they have. Part of that, I think, is the ballpark, because the ballpark is rather small. It's not one of these gargantuan facilities. It's in a neighborhood. It's the same ballpark that's been around for 112 years, I believe. And Yaz is just one of those workman-like guys. Never was glorious in terms of his persona. He just had a workman-like persona, which New Englanders love. And if you take someone like Reggie Jackson, well, New Yorkers loved Reggie because he was brash and he had a swagger about him. A lot of this is geographical. A lot of this is how you grew up. But I always admired Yastrzemski because he just went out and did the job, and it was just a workman. And you don't get to 3,000 hits. I remember the night he got the 3,000th hit when he singled off the Yankees and it went into right field. There was just something very, I don't want to say peaceful, but reassuring that you don't have athletes, even back then, who are all out for money, all out for fame, all out for glory. They just want to go and do the job. And I understand why he might be a Red Sox fan's favorite player.
Yeah, and he's obviously one of the greatest players of all time. You know, you talked about Fenway Park, and I always thought that that's where they played for the history, and it's not true. Their first game was at Huntington Avenue grounds, where the Red Sox history actually began.
Right.
Could you tell us who was the first owner of the Red Sox?
Well, I believe it was a guy named John Young, although I might have that wrong because I don't have the book in front of me. But there were a few owners until Mr. Yawkey, and I think that the Huntington Avenue grounds chapter was important to me for the reason you said, that I didn't want people to think it was the Red Sox and Fenway for 100% of the history. There was a ballpark or a facility that was not as well known. I certainly hadn't heard of it. And the more I went into the research, the more I said, well, geez, I have to find out more. And when I did my research trip to Boston to look at microfilm up there, I got as many newspapers as I could to get the account of the game. And back then, they were pretty good. I mean, they didn't have Retro Sheet or Baseball Reference, but they were pretty good back then about at-bats and telling you what happened. It makes it easier for researchers to chronicle games from 100, 120 years ago.
Yeah, and there was a person named Charles Summers, who owned the Americans, and they eventually became the Red Sox, correct?
Right. The Americans were the original name, or was the original name, and the what we know as the Braves actually started as the Red Stockings.
Mm-hmm.
That team underwent a variety of name changes: Doves, Bees, Braves, And of course, the Red Sox were able to take the moniker when the Boston NL club said, well, we're not going to use it anymore.
Right. And the Braves are still around today in Atlanta.
They're still around today. Absolutely.
David, one of my fondest, it's not even a game, but baseball memories. You mentioned that Fenway Park is a neighborhood park, and it is. And just to remind everyone, we are talking to David Krell. The book is The Fenway Effect, A Cultural History of the Boston Red Sox. It was back in 88, and it was the playoffs were over, and I was living in Boston. I was doing an internship in Boston. And somebody came and gave me a ride, and we were passing by. They knew I was a fan. I don't know if they keep the stadium open like this now, but they were doing work. The lights were on, and I was able to walk down onto the field and run the bases at Fenway Park. Well, there were no bases, but run on the field. I got to go touch the big green monster, and it was an incredible experience just for me. And you could feel the history, you know. You really can. You could really. What a stadium that is!
I recommend anyone going to Boston to take a tour of Fenway. They have these young kids who are so knowledgeable about the team. I mean, they're like in their late teens, early 20s. They are more than happy to answer questions. They don't care where you're from. They don't care if you wear a Yankees hat. And like you said, you can feel the history. It's palpable. When you see the green monster up close, when they take you around the ballpark and they take you to different vantage points, it's incredible. It's just an incredible feeling.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, answer this. So, of course, you know, there's the curse of the Bambino, because we all know Babe Ruth was a Red Sox. I think he won three championships with them, with the Red Sox, I think. It was, right? Didn't he? It wasn't a three with the Red Sox?
I believe so.
You know, he was mostly a pitcher for them, and then he was hitting a little bit. Of course, they hit, but I'm just saying he wasn't the Babe Ruth we know now.
Right.
And of course, the owner of the Red Sox was Frazee, right? And he sold him to the Yankees. And everybody thinks that he sold him to put money towards his theatrical pursuits. Is that true?
Not really. People think it was to finance No No Nanette. And there's a little bit of truth that he needed money. But the fact of the matter is, it was not a universally disliked move. When I went to the microfilm of the Boston newspapers, there were some sports writers who said good riddance to bad rubbish. Ruth was not a team player. Ruth was boisterous. Now, back then, hitting home runs might not be seen as being a team player. So you have to take that into account. What was the paradigm of sportsmanship back then? Now, if you get a guy who hits 50 home runs, you're joyous.
Sure.
Guy who hits 50 home runs on your team, that's a great acquisition. But back then, some people just preferred old-fashioned hit and run, bunt the guy over, that kind of baseball. Ruth in New York, obviously, was a match made in heaven. He did very well in New York. Was there a curse? If you believe in that sort of thing, maybe. I mean, they lost in 46 and 67 and 75 and 86, finally winning in 2004. And it's a nice story. But what gets me is when Red Sox fans complain about all of these disappointments, and yet I have to remind them, yeah, but you had the Celtics. And you had the Bruins of the 70s, the Celtics of the 60s. You have the, you know, it's not like it was devoid of any championships since 1920.
Right.
you had more championships in basketball than most cities have in a lifetime.
Exactly.
so let's try to put some of this in perspective.
Yeah. Well, if you New York basketball fan, you're waiting over 50 years.
Oh, my God, yes.
Yes, absolutely. And speaking about Babe Ruth, when he did come to the Yankees, he did, I believe, he saved baseball because that was right after the 1919 Black Sox scandal. So, that you know, a huge, huge move. And like you said, a perfect marriage made in heaven. Let's talk about some movies, because the Red Sox has been prominently featured in some movies. Fear Strike Out, about Jimmy Pearsall. Although Mr. Pearsall wasn't too happy with that movie, was he?
No, he thought that the role of his dad was exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
His dad wasn't as bad as the movie makes him out to be. But he did have mental issues, Jimmy mm-hmm. Pearsall. And that's something that wasn't talked about at the dinner table in 1957.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So to see it on a big screen, to see Tony Perkins going through that torture was revolutionary
mm-hmm.
and probably helped a lot of people seeking psychiatric help after that. It really wasn't until the 70s that therapy and psychiatry became okay to talk about. That's when you started to see it in popular culture quite a bit. But back then, not really. And he was a tortured soul.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Another movie, as Len mentioned before, Fever Pitch. And of course, my favorite scene is when Jimmy Fallon is sitting on his rear watching the Buckner game. And that floored me. That's so funny.
My favorite is when Drew Barrymore jumps down onto the turf.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing Jimmy Fallon asks her is, wait a minute, so the turf, is it sunny? She runs across the expanse of the stadium grass, and the uh-huh. first question he has is, not why are you here, what are you doing? It's like, the turf, is it spongy?
Right.
I thought that was just so funny.
And I mentioned Buckner saying that scene was funny, and it was a funny scene, but Bill Buckner was really vilified in Boston after the 1986 World Series. And that's a shame.
The guy has more than 2,700 hits.
I know.
I'm not saying that he belongs in the Hall of Fame, but I think he belongs in the discussion.
Sure.
Yes.
It was so important to me to mention him and to do a chapter about him in the Curb Your Enthusiasm context. I couldn't just do something about him.
Mm-hmm.
Because that just, I couldn't justify that. But because he did that guest spot on Curb, I was able to remind people and myself, wait a minute, this guy was a pretty solid ball player. And you can't judge a career based on one error in one game when there are so many other mistakes
mm-hmm.
that happened playing-wise, managerial-wise, in that game. One is that he shouldn't have even been playing.
Right.
I mean, I found an article from a few days before that questioned his body, his physical ability. And even to this day, guys, I don't even know if he handled the ball, if he fielded the ball, would he have even beat Mookie Wilson to the bag? I've looked at that play 50 times and I just can't make a determination.
Yeah, Mookie always said it would have been close.
It would have been very close because he was tremendously fast and Buckner's legs were not what they used to be and he was injured.
Mm-hmm.
So playing deep at first, and then you have to go against one of the fastest runners on the Mets, maybe one of the fastest runners in baseball. You have to field it, get your footing, sprint to the bag. I don't know that he would have beaten Mookie.
And the game was tied at that point.
Right.
The game was absolutely tied. You know,
Boston still had game seven.
Sure. And they were winning game seven.
Right.
They had the lead.
Right.
You know, we know about Ralph Branca and Bobby Thompson, who they went on and did card shows and became great
friends.
Same thing with Mookie and Bill Buckner. They made a living. Bill Buckner said he sent his kids to college on that.
Yeah. Yeah. He said one play. I'm noted for one play. Like Doug Flutie, he's noted for the Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. He had a professional career. But if Doug Flutie goes to memorabilia shows, I bet you that he's signing photos of the Hail Mary pass.
Sure.
Yeah. Went to Boston College, right? So another Boston. Yeah. And you mentioned Curb Your Enthusiasm, and that episode really kind of made it like he's okay with it. Or, I mean, when the baby drops and bounces and he catches it.
Well, it's a warm moment in a show that's not known for warm moments.
Right.
And it was incredibly funny. It was incredibly poignant at the end. And I was able to find an interview that Larry David did with Rich Eisen, which I quote from in the book and cite to it. And it was not a done deal. You know, Bill Buckner had to be persuaded. And I think he made the right decision. I think he probably had fun with it. And it did redeem him in a way. But he's one of my favorite players. He just does not get the recognition that he deserves. Same with Steve Garvey, these first basemen, these workmanlike guys who just, people might say they're compilers, but no ball player goes up to the plate and says, well, this is going to be my 1158th hit. It just doesn't work that way.
No, maybe for Pete Rose it did, but...
But, you know, also, I used to have a different opinion of compilers, but knowing now what it takes to get ready every season and to put their bodies through that year after year, to be able to compile is quite a feat. So,
well, now it's even harder because they train all year round.
Right. Yeah. Right. But, you know, so Bill Buckner was vilified, but who gave up the home run to, well, it was Torres who gave up the home run to Bucky Dent. And I don't remember hearing he being vilified like Buckner was. And that home run really sealed their fate and they lost that game. And, you know, that was it. And Bucky Dent, oh, he's loved in Boston. So
he is definitely not loved in Boston. But again, here's a guy who... is known for that one moment, like Bobby Thompson. It overshadows a pretty decent career. Yankees fans remember him. I remember him from the late 70s. He was a pretty solid shortstop, MVP of the 78 series. And that one pitch is what people remember him for when he smacked it over the Green Monster.
Yeah. Yeah, and let's talk about some rivalries of the Yankees and Red Sox. When they're both winning, it's a great rivalry. It's not like the Cubs and Cardinals, no matter what year, no matter how they're doing the standings, it's a great rivalry. Same thing with the Dodgers and Giants. But when the Red Sox and Yankees are both winning, it was like in 78 and 77, 78, that was unbelievable, those pennant races.
Yeah.
And, you know, Lennon mentioned the Bucky Dent, but also Tim Wakefield, who was loved in Boston, gave up the home run to Boone, to Aaron Boone in the 2003 playoffs. I mean,
this rivalry goes back to the 1900s. It really is a special rivalry. It's right up there with UCLA and USC, with the Dodgers and the Giants. There's something very, very energetic when you go to Yankee Stadium and you see Red Sox jerseys, and same goes for Fenway with Yankees jerseys. I was at a Yankees Red Sox game at Yankee Stadium. It was a little jarring because I saw maybe five or six couples where the man is wearing a Yankees jersey, the woman's wearing a Red Sox jersey or vice versa. And I'm thinking, okay, how does this mixed marriage work? what is this about? Cause I just can't imagine if you're some fans are just very vocal, very dedicated. And I just can't imagine what that household is like during playoff time. If they, pennant race time, if they're all vying for the pennant.
Now, I can imagine as Jeff was reading this book, and it's all good, and I'm going to say it again, it's the Fenway effect. We're talking to David Krell. It's called, it's the Fenway effect, a cultural history of the Boston Red Sox, David must have a short-term memory loss because he's now with us for the third time. He doesn't remember how much he dislikes being on each time. We appreciate it.
I love being on with you guys.
I love being on with people
who appreciate history, but also read the book. We were talking before air. It's so difficult when you go on an interview and somebody says, "So David, Carl Yastrzemski," with no context and no background, no introduction, no setup.
You know, well, it's very funny because, and we appreciate that. We had someone on who wrote Baseball the Movie, and they said they were on a show, and obviously the person didn't even crack open the book because he said, "So Baseball the Movie, oh, what's that about? What's the movie about?" And yeah. I was like, "No, it's all about movies that have been baseball." So I'm just saying, but what I wanted to say with Jeff is I'm sure he's reading the book, he's loving it, but you have a chapter, Tom Seaver.
Yes.
Jeff's favorite player of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff, how'd that chapter make you feel?
Well, and we all know Tom Seaver was giving advice to the Red Sox in the 86 World Series. I mean, that was his team. He was on the Red Sox. He was near... Just before the Buckner incident, he was at the end of the dugout talking to Buddy Harrelson, you know, "Give me the ball when you're done," or something like that. So, you know, it was sad to see Seaver like on that team, though. That's me.
I was not sure that the chapter would make it. Some people might have thought it was extraneous, but I felt it was warranted. I was born and raised a Mets fan, pretty much. And to honor this player in his last season, but also make the point that he's a nostalgic figure. It wasn't just any future Hall of Famer that was with the Red Sox. It was Tom Seaver. He is, by definition, a nostalgic figure. And the 80s, especially the mid-80s, were awash in nostalgia. So I wanted to make that connection. But also little tidbits like Seaver tutoring Clements and saying to him, you know, "Do your thing. Do your thing. Don't let people mess with your mechanics. You've got a good motion. You've got good delivery. Do your thing. Play your game." And that was so rich to find that. I was so glad that I saw that connection.
Yeah, of course, Tom Seaver would be my favorite player, and Roger Clemens, not so much. So, but whatever. And David, we really thank you for your time. We have a couple more questions. You have a chapter here of sluggers and statues. And I remember going to Fenway Park and loved seeing that statue named the teammates.
Yeah.
Bobby Doerr, Johnny Pesky, Dom DiMaggio, and Ted Williams. That's a great statue.
It is great, and I was very glad to chronicle that and put a little art into it. I took an architecture class in college, and I never forgot it. One of our assignments was to analyze a memorial or a monument in the Washington, D.C. area. I went to the University of Maryland, and I always loved that part of the class, and it stayed with me. So when I was looking around for different topics, I was a little short. And I said, well, what else can I do here? There must be statues. And I found the Ted Williams statue, the Carl Yastrzemski statue, and the one that you mentioned, the teammates.
Yeah. And the one with Ted Williams is very poignant, putting a hat on a kid.
Right.
Yeah. That's great. Great. And you went on to talk about how the sculpture came upon doing it that way.
Well, that's another fascinating story. When you talk to the artist or you research the history, the genesis of how it came to be, I think that's just a wonderful, wonderful life story to put in there, because the statue takes on a life of its own. We all go to our different ballparks and we see the different monuments, the statues. They all affect us in the same way or in a different way sometimes. But I just look in awe because that one statue is capturing a Hall of Fame career. Or in the case of the teammates, it's that bond that Williams had with these other guys that just you don't hear about regarding other teams. Maybe the Dodgers, but not as much. I don't hear about the Boys of Summer. I don't see a Boys of Summer statue outside Dodger Stadium. There was something about the bond that Pesky and I think didn't Pesky grow up in San Diego with?
I believe so.
Ted Williams. So, they had a friendship going back to their teenage years, and it was a lot of fun to chronicle that.
Yeah, and I was going to say Ted Williams is nicknamed the Kid.
Mm-hmm.
Put a hat on a kid.
Right.
It was just a beautiful statue, and I remember it well. Before we let you go, I'd like to ask you about the 2004 playoffs against the Yankees. They were down 0-3. No one has ever come back from down 0-3 against ever in any series. And Boston, they did it one game at a time. It was the Bloody Sox game. It was David Ortiz hitting some great home runs in extra innings. We've had John Vampatella on our show talking about game 5 of that series. That really started the Red Sox having a really great, I mean, they didn't do too much in the 1900s, but in the 2000s, they have four world championships that the Yankees only have one.
Yeah, that series against the Yankees is just one of these magical competitions that makes baseball. People forget how great the other Red Sox teams were. 67 against Bob Gibson and the Cardinals, 7 games against the Mets, 7 games in 46 against the Cardinals, 7 games. As somebody says in the documentary that HBO produced, there was no pressure. There was no pressure on Boston for that fourth game. They're down 3-0. So if they lose, they lose. If they win one and lose, they lose. They're used to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, so we'll come back next year. We know how to handle this. We've been here before. They got something, momentum, karma, call it what you will. But there was definitely something in the air for Red Sox fans in 04.
Yes. And, you know, we talk about the Red Sox. I mean, there's other players that we haven't talked about. Jim Rice, Carlton Fisk.
Fred Lynn.
Fred Lynn.
Tony Conigliaro.
Tony Conigliaro. Yeah, another, that's a tragically story. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's in the book too. And I really felt because when Tony C got hit, he was pretty much sidelined. And there's a point in the book where they win the AL pennant in 67, and he just feels separated. He doesn't feel a part of the team because he wasn't playing. Well, it's not like he got beaned in April. This was deep into the summer, but he felt so bad. He loved the team so much that he just didn't feel like he could celebrate. Even though everybody's telling him, hey, you're as much a part of this as anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
David, I just want to stress to people that are listening to this, I guess, I'm going to stress to people who aren't listening to this, but that it is a book about Boston and their love affair with their sports. But it's so much history. If you are a fan of baseball and if you're listening to this show, chances are you are, this is something you're going to want to read because the Red Sox are one of the oldest teams. Yeah. And the history is rich. And as a baseball fan, this is a wonderful recollection of their history. So I hope that people listening do not think that, oh, well, you know, I'm not a Red Sox fan or, you know, because it's baseball history. And it's Babe Ruth that, like you said, Fred Lynn, Yastrzemski, Ted Williams, probably maybe the greatest hitter of all time. I mean, this is... Highly recommend this book. It is The Fenway Effect. We're speaking to David Krell. a cultural history of the Boston Red Sox, but it can be, it's so much more than that. I just want to thank you for coming on with us again. We're so thankful. We can't wait for you to write another book. So we want you back.
And before we let you go, how are you doing with the New Jersey chapter of Sabre?
Great. We have people who are speaking at the Cooperstown Symposium, and I'm one of them, I'm happy to say. And we're great. People should check us out. If they want to go to the Society for American Baseball Research website, you can find the Northern New Jersey chapter, also known as Elysian Fields. And I'm on there. You can email me. I'll put you on the list. It's great fun. It's great fun to talk once a month with like-minded people. And we get authors, we get other contributors to just talk about history, talk about their opinions. We have campfire sessions where we pick a topic. Sometimes the topic is who should be in the Hall of Fame, who's not. Sometimes the topic is what's your favorite baseball movie. And sometimes it's just updating people on what you're doing. What research are you working on? What article are you working on? What book proposal are you working on? And it's become a great source of camaraderie and support. And I'm really privileged to be a part of it.
Well, thank you very much. We enjoyed having you on for the third time. We hope we make it a fourth time with your next book. And thank you very much for being on Baseball and BBQ.
Thanks, guys. Take care.
And thank you, David Krell, for joining us again on Baseball and BBQ. Next time you write a book, he's always welcome back.
Well, it's not his third book, but it is his third time with us.
Right.
So, David, he wants to get back on quickly, so he'll put out another book. I mean, his books are excellent. And I encourage anyone who's thinking about purchasing one, go back, listen to him on other episodes, and you'll end up purchasing every book he's ever written.
Yes, absolutely. He's a great writer. And you can find his stuff on davidkrell.com.
All right, Jeff, would you agree with me that we've done a hell of a lot of show?
Of course.
All right, so then we will tell everyone that we are presented by Bet Online. It is where the game starts, but this show is not starting. It is ending. So we thank everyone for joining us. We thank Ray Sheehan. We thank Doug Scheiding. We thank Denise. We thank David Krell. We thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Len.
You are very welcome.
The listeners.
Thank you to the listeners. And now we end the show by saying, how do we end, Jeff?
With the poet.
Shel Krakowski.
And the musician.
Dave Dresser.
And the songs.
Baseball always brings you home.
And we'll see you next time in episode 245.